Hello, I am up here in the corner, and I understand how odd this is to have a speaker like this, and I would much, as you would much prefer to be back together again. I remember being at the hall down there and enjoying my time with you. So thank you for the invitation to be back. Hopefully next time I'm back, we'll all be together in a room rather than this very, very strange way of communicating. But let's make the best of it. The book that I've been asked to speak to you about today is this one. I'm not going to share my screen and go back and forth and show you pictures, because we are all of a generation that we grew up being able to pay attention, and so I don't need those flashy things. So this is the book that I'm going to talk to you about, and it's called The Devil's Trick, How Canada Fought the Vietnam War. And I've had a number of people ask me, what do you mean how Canada fought the Vietnam War? And that's exactly what the book is about, because it was our war. We were very much involved. So let me tell you a little bit about how indeed we were involved. I'm not going to tell you much about the Vietnam War. It's not about the war. It's not about the battles. It's not about all those kinds of things. There's lots of books for that. What this is about is Canada's involvement. Canada's involvement began in 1954. In 1954, France had been involved in Vietnam as a conquering nation that colonized the whole area of Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. It became known as French Indochina. 350 years before, they got kicked out by the Chinese, they got kicked out by the Japanese. After the Second World War, they came back, and there was then a gentleman by the name of Ho Chi Minh, who was organizing an army and a number of people who were guerrilla fighters to try to kick the French out. Ho Chi Minh said, basically, I have three goals. I want all of the foreigners out, and this meant the French, and the American money that was backing them up. At one point in this civil war, this nationalist war, this colonial war, the Americans were footing 80% of the bill for the French. 58,000 French people died fighting in that war between the Second World War and the 1954. Ho Chi Minh said, I want the foreigners out. I want there to be one united Vietnam, and I want me to be the leader. The Communist Party that he was leading, the Vietnamese Communist Party. In 1954, the French finally decided, yes, we want out. And so the big powers, China, United States, Britain, France, got together in Geneva, where all these kinds of meetings are held, and they organized, here is what we are going to do with Vietnam. I know they involve Laos and Cambodia too, but we're focusing mostly on Vietnam. Here's what will happen. We'll give 300 days for the French to get the French out, all their soldiers, all their equipment, all their military gear. Anybody from the southern part of the country that wants to move north, go ahead. Anybody from the northern part of the country that wants to move south, go ahead. For these 300 days, Ho Chi Minh and you communists, you go ahead and rule the northern part just for the first while. And then Diem, who is a guy of pretty corrupt guy, and we'll talk about him a little bit more. You go ahead and rule the South just for a while. And then in 1956, in July, there will be an election, and all of the people of Vietnam will decide who they want to rule, and everybody will go home. Now, that's a good idea. We'll cut the country at the 17th parallel temporarily, and this is what will happen. But they said, we need some kind of not peacekeepers, but sort of like police force, almost like traffic guards, to go in and make sure that everybody is moving, the French are leaving, the north and south, and all that movement of people and equipment happens in a way that is peaceful and doesn't tip them back into war again. So they said, okay, let's get three countries, one representing the non-aligned states, non-aligned in the Cold War that was going on. Well, that was going to be India. And let's get a country to represent the communist world. That was Poland. Let's get a country to represent the Western world, the Western in this Cold War. Canada was chosen. The Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Louis Saint-Laurent, do you know how he found out that Canada had been chosen to be part of this tripartite organization called the International Control Commission? Do you know how he found out? He read about it in the Globe and Mail. They didn't ask Canada. They didn't inform Canada officially. They just picked Canada, and Canada was in. So when did Canada become involved in the Vietnam War? 1954. The external affairs minister at the time was a guy named Lester Pearson, and he said, my God, if we're going to have a whole bunch of soldiers and diplomats over there overseeing this 300 days and making sure that a war doesn't begin again, we need somebody who is a really good diplomat, who is a really good soldier, who understands the war and warlike conditions, and we need somebody with a lot of law experience because this is going to be complex. And he chose a friend that he met when he was a student at Oxford, a guy who was a brigadier general. He had fought and been wounded at Passchendaele in the First World War. He had fought in the Second World War. He was wounded at Dieppe. And then he was wounded leading men into France 3 days after D-Day. And his name was Brigadier General Sherwood Lett. Sherwood Lett went to Vietnam in 1954, leading about 350 Canadian diplomats and soldiers to oversee this very fragile peace. He arrived in Hanoi in July 1954, and he was met by a big brass band. His big white limousine car picked him up, and he thought, this is marvelous. They took him from the Hanoi airport to the Metropole Hotel, and there was cheering from the crowds that were there on the sidewalks, waving and singing songs, and there was flags and bunting on buildings. They thought, this is an amazing reception. And he pulled into the hotel, and he walked up to the guy at reception. He said, this is an amazing welcome that I've enjoyed. And the guy said, well, I hate to embarrass you, sir, but we're expecting the Russian ambassador on the next plane, and I think the crowd thinks that it's you. What Sherwood Lett found out is never trust things in Vietnam. Things in Vietnam are never as they seem. So for over a year, Sherwood Lett did, and the Canadians did what they could to try to make all of the things happen that I told you about. And then it came time to prepare for the election that was going to let the Vietnamese people decide how they wanted their country to carry on. Because he spoke French and was able to speak to so many Vietnamese people who were French-speaking because the French had ruled for over 350 years, he wrote memo after memo back, cables back. These are all in the archives in Ottawa. And I read all of his cables, and he was telling Pearson, who was telling Saint-Laurent, who was then telling President Eisenhower, the American president, you know, when this election happens, Ho Chi Minh is going to win in a landslide. The people of Vietnam in the north think he's an incredible leader, and they want him to lead the whole country. Listen to this. The people in the south overwhelmingly think that Diem, the leader of the South Vietnam government, is corrupt, in it only for himself and his family, and is doing nothing for the people of, at that point, South Vietnam. Therefore, the people in the south overwhelmingly want Ho Chi Minh and the communists to win. Overwhelmingly. And Lett said, despite that fact, we must allow this election to happen, even though we know the communists are going to win. In a walk, they're going to win. No Trump-like rigged election here. They are going to win. Eisenhower said, we can't allow that to happen. Pearson and Saint-Laurent and the British leader and the French leader all said, we can't allow this election to happen. Lett wrote more cables back, and he said, if this election does not happen, there is going to be an enormous outcry from the people of the North and South, because they want it to happen and they want Ho Chi Minh to win. If this election is not allowed to happen and this temporary division becomes permanent, there is going to be a civil war, and this civil war will be like nothing we've seen before, because Ho Chi Minh's men and women in this force as well, that were becoming known as the Viet Cong, are going to overrun both the North and the South. And this civil war will be bloody, it will be long, and they will win. And you know what the North, what the United States did and Britain did and Canada did? They ignored Lett's advice. And they did not allow the election to happen. Imagine the irony of the communist North Vietnamese, the communist Russians, and the communist Chinese saying, we want this democratic election to happen. And the democratic Americans, Brits, and Canadians said, we will not allow this democratic election to happen. So there's Canada offering a way to stop the American Vietnam War before it even began. But that wasn't the first time. What I do in this book is I separate the six elements of how Canada was involved in the Vietnam War into six parts, and each part has one person, and that person's story leads us through that part of the story. Sherwood Lett is obviously chapter one. What I'm going to do really briefly is go through each of those. The second person that we are introduced to in the book, The Devil's Trick, is Blair Seaborn. I was really fortunate that I got to meet Blair Seaborn. I went to Ottawa and met him. He subsequently died. He was in his 90s. There was no failure of memory or intellect or ability to communicate in the fact that he was 96. I was very impressed by his ability to recall arcane facts from years ago and to help me to tell this part of the story. In 1965, American President Johnson knew, even in late 1964, that it was falling apart. Diem had been assassinated. It was chaos in the South Vietnamese government. He knew that most of the people in the South wanted a communist rule, wanted Ho Chi Minh to win. And he also knew, because he had been told by the CIA and he'd been told by the military leaders, that if the Americans went in with a whole bunch of soldiers, they would never win. They could not win this war. But he had no way of getting out. So he met in private in a hotel room in New York City in a secret meeting with Lester Pearson, who was now prime minister at the end of 1964. And President Johnson said, I want to take a message to the North Vietnamese to make a deal so that we, the Americans, can get out. Now, I want South Vietnam to remain a quasi-democratic state. I don't want the communists to take over all of Vietnam, but I want the Americans out. So could you take a message to the North Vietnamese? Because there's no American embassy in North Vietnam. There's no back channel. And Pearson agreed. Now, as they left the hotel, there was a whole bunch of reporters there. And they said to the reporters, oh, we just happened to be in New York City at the same time, and we were just talking about sports and plays that are on Broadway. I'm glad that politicians don't lie to us anymore, but that's what they told the press on that day. The pick for the person who would take this message forward was Blair Seaborn, a diplomat of great renown. He'd been a diplomat for years and had served in Russia. And he went to North Vietnam, arrived at what was a very huge building that had been the French ambassador's building at the time, the French governor's building, went into this incredibly large, ornate room with huge high ceilings. I learned all this not from books or from the archives, but from Blair Seaborn himself. And he met with the Prime Minister of North Vietnam. He told him the deal, whereby the Americans would leave if only these North Vietnamese would allow the South to stand. And he then heard back from the North Vietnamese that, no, we can't do that, but please let the Americans leave. We will wait 6 months to a year before we take over South Vietnam. If you do not leave, if the Americans do not leave, there will be a long and a bloody war, and this war will be something that you have never seen and that you can never win. Blair Seaborn then spent 3 or 4 days going around Vietnam, North Vietnam, speaking to other leaders, speaking to people on the street, business leaders, mayors of towns. He then wrote 3 long cables back to Pearson and to Eisenhower in which he basically said, take this deal. Americans, leave. If you stay, there will be a war, and these people are determined that they will win, and they will win because they have the people behind them. Not only the people in the North, but the people in the South are behind them and anti-American. You will not win this war. Get out now. He was ignored. He met with the North Vietnamese 4 more times. And each time he pleaded with Johnson, please take this deal and leave. And Johnson would not. That's the second time that a Canadian had a route to peace, a route away from war, and he was ignored. What is sad is that in 1973, when Richard Nixon, President Nixon, signed the deal that finally got the Americans out of Vietnam, do you know what the deal was? Exactly the deal that Blair Seaborn said in 1964 that they should accept. In 1965, the Americans went in and they started to, as a number of us, I see that I have similar hair color to everyone here. We remember the Vietnam War started small and escalated and escalated and escalated until there was over 500,000 soldiers, American soldiers in Vietnam. Well, one day in 1967, there was a woman. Let me tell you about a woman named Claire Culhane. She was a 48-year-old hospital administrator in Montreal. Single mom. She'd been divorced years before. She read in her Saturday newspaper. Remember when the Saturday newspapers were like that thick? And in the middle of the Saturday newspaper, there was a weekend magazine. Remember those days? And in the weekend, I like speaking with groups that are a similar age to me. This is great because you remember this stuff. I don't have to explain. I used to get the Saturday magazine and the weekend magazine. There used to be a picture of a hockey player, you know, so cut it out. There was Gordie Howe and Andy Bathgate and stuff up in my bedroom wall. So she read this weekend magazine, and I got a copy out of it at the archives. And there it is. There's a cover picture of a Canadian doctor and nurse treating South Vietnamese kids in South Vietnam. Canada had a number, 5 hospitals that Canadian taxpayers paid for. Canadian External Affairs built and staffed these hospitals. And here was Claire Culhane. She said, I'm a hospital administrator. I think I would like a little adventure in my life, and I want to do something good. And so, therefore, she signed up with External Affairs, and within 6 months, she was on the coast, right on the seacoast, the east coast of Vietnam, right up near the border with North Vietnam, working in a Canadian hospital staffed by Canadian doctors and Canadian nurses. It was a tuberculosis hospital, but they were treating wounded people that were in, and in the book, I tell a couple, I could have gone on and on, but of just horrific wounds and horrific things that she was seeing. And she was there for a year, but after 6 months, she decided to leave. She couldn't do it. And it was not the horror of war that got to her, although that was palpable. It was the hypocrisy of war that forced her to leave. What she saw and what she came to understand when she arrived back home and did a little bit more digging is that while one part of the Canadian government was building hospitals for the wounded in Vietnam, another part of the Canadian government was providing the weaponry that was creating those wounded. She discovered and wrote long reports that she gave to the government that were shelved and ignored, that the Canadian government was making about $370 million a year in building weaponry and war material that was sold to the American Pentagon for use in Vietnam. $370 million a year is the equivalent of about $2 billion a year now. So picture $2 billion a year in war material going to the Vietnam War. And it was a wide range of stuff. Canadian factories and American subsidiaries in Canada were making everything from boots to shoelaces to guidance systems to armored vehicles. A company in Winnipeg was making the Green Berets, the iconic Green Berets that the Marines wore. They were made in Winnipeg. They were also making napalm. Napalm, the gaseous stuff that is dropped from the sky, and when it touches your skin, literally burns your skin away, and you die hoping for death because the pain is so horrific. You may remember that photograph, a very famous photograph, of a little girl running naked after her village was napalmed. A lot of that napalm was made in Canada. Something else that Canada made in Alliston, Ontario, was Agent Orange. Agent Orange was the stuff that was dropped from the sky in order to be a defoliant and burn all the leaves off trees, and so that the Americans could see the Viet Cong that were hiding under the canopy of the jungle leaves. Well, that was all well and good, but if it went into the water supply, went into the food supply, or if it touched anybody, it set off a range of cancers that people are still dying from today. Babies are still being born in Vietnam with horrific birth defects today. Much of that Agent Orange was made in Canada. Claire Culhane went across Canada speaking in church basements at universities and groups like this, and Kiwanis meetings and things like that, trying to get Canadians to understand and trying to get Canadians to stand up against this hypocrisy of, one, saying we were neutral, where we weren't, two, saying Canada's involved in the Vietnam War, that's the Americans' war. I see it every night in the news. When I watch Walter Cronkite, Canada's are not involved with that, but we were. She held a number of events where she tried to bring attention to her plight. And in one event, she held a fast, a 10-day fast, right there on Parliament Hill. She had no trucks with her. She arrived with a launcher. And she sat by the eternal flame there. And a number of members of Parliament came out. One of them was Jean Marchand. I don't know if you remember the Trudeau, first Trudeau the dad, and Jean Marchand, very powerful cabinet minister, came out and began a discussion with her that turned into a debate, that turned into an argument, turned into a shouting match where Jean Marchand said, do you want to be the one to tell 130,000 Canadians that they're out of work because we no longer want to sell weapons to the Vietnam War, to the Americans to be used in Vietnam? And there is the crux of it right there. The equivalent of $2 billion a year and 130,000 jobs, which would be like 250,000 jobs now. Are we going to sell our principles for profit? Are we going to sell our principles for jobs? Well, what would we say now? And that's what Claire Culhane was trying to bring about, trying to get people to see. There's a guy that I, let me tell you about a guy named Joe Erickson. I've known Joe Erickson for years. He's a he lives near me. I live here in Lakefield, and he lives down near Hastings. And he enjoys horses. He's one of these guys that the great big Belgians and the that he has to pull wagons and things and sleigh rides in the winter with kids and stuff. That's how I got to meet him. And I've known him for a long time. And he asked me once, we were out for a walk, and he asked me, so what are you writing now? Because he knows I'm always writing another book. And I said, well, I'm writing about the Vietnam War, Canada's involved in the Vietnam War. He said, oh, really? Did you know I'm a draft dodger? No, I didn't know. I've known the guy for 15 years. I didn't know. I knew he was from the States, but I didn't know he was a draft dodger. And he told me the story of how he was one of 30,000, about 30,000 Canadian or Americans who decided to move up here. And I think many of us know the stories of the draft dodgers. There's one story that he told me, though, that I was not aware of. And that was in 2003. He decided that he was going to go down and visit his family and for a high school reunion. whatever number it was, 40 or 50 years from high school. And so he got to the border, and the guy looked at him, looked at his passport, looked back at him, said, drive your car right over there, wait. He was taken in by two armed officers, put in a steel room. He said the walls were steel, no windows, and the table was steel, and the two chairs were steel. And they came in, and they questioned him. They interrogated him for almost an hour, and he had no idea how they knew so much about him. When he got to it, they finally released him, and when he got down to he lived in Minnesota. When he got to Minnesota, his older sister said, oh, yeah, that's probably about all the FBI harassment that happened after he left. It was only then, when he was in his 60s, that he found out that the 60s were having their revenge. He found out how the FBI had harassed his family for years after he had gone north to Canada, lived in Winnipeg, came to Toronto, and then eventually in a farm near Hastings. I found out that that happened to many, many people. The FBI harassed their families relentlessly, ruthlessly. That was an element of the story I didn't know. Another element of the story I didn't know was that polls throughout that era said that the majority of Canadians did not want the draft dodgers here. They hated the idea of the draft dodgers being here. Many of them mixed them up with deserters, the people who had been to war or had been drafted or enlisted and then took their uniforms off and came to Canada. They didn't like deserters. But even the draft dodgers, they hadn't been drafted yet. They just decided we are not fighting in this war that we found tomorrow. There were many organizations that were set up. There was one in Peterborough. I don't know if there was one in Lindsay or not, but there was one in Peterborough. There was big ones in Toronto and Ottawa and all the big cities of Canada that would help the draft dodgers when they arrived. And they would help them to find food and help them find clothing and a place to work and all of those kinds of things. And the organizations were helped both financially and logistics support by churches. The polling that was done, internal polling done in churches, said the majority of church leaders liked the idea of supporting the draft dodgers. The people in the pews, though, the majority of them did not. And they didn't for a number of reasons. I've already talked about one. Another is so many of the young people that were coming in, especially in 1967, 8, 9, had long hair. They wore weird clothes. They listened to that rock and roll music that's going to send us all to hell. And they were mixing in with good Canadian kids and leading good Canadian kids astray. I read and I put in the book some of the things that were said by the mayor of Toronto, the mayor of Vancouver especially, who said horrific things. The mayor of Vancouver said every problem in this city can be traced to the hippies and draft dodgers. I'm getting rid of them all. So it was interesting. I think we know about the draft dodgers. What I didn't know was that negative reception that so many of them had and that so many of the families left in the United States suffered. Of course, I go into more detail in the book. There was another guy I met. He lives outside of Ottawa in a place called Carleton Place. I don't know if you know Carleton Place, a little town this side of Ottawa. He's got a house out of the country. And his name is Doug Carey. When Doug Carey was 16 years old, he quit school and traveled the country. And then when he was 18 years old, he was sitting with his grandmother and he saw the 6 o'clock news. 6 o'clock news always had, I don't know if you recall, about Vietnam every night, the Vietnam War. Walter Cronkite talking about the Vietnam War over and over and over. And he said to his grandmother, I'm going to enlist. I'm going to go to the United States and I'm going to fight in the American Army. And he did. He did a tour and a half, almost 2 tours in Vietnam. What I discovered in my research is over 20,000 Canadians. Over 20,000 Canadians went to the United States, enlisted, and went and fought in Vietnam. Over 170 of them died. I don't know if you've ever been to Washington, D.C. You've seen the great big war memorial that is there right by Lincoln, the great big slash of marble. It's an incredible thing to visit. It's like going into a church. It's a spiritual experience. There are 170 Canadian names on that monument. Thousands came back, like Doug Carey did, wounded, both in their bodies, in their spirits, and in their emotions. 170 died. Over 7,000 were wounded, seriously wounded. There is no count to how many came back suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Doug Carey told me, he's in his 70s now, he said that he's an avid golfer. He loves getting out two or three times a week, but he said on the course that he plays, there are three fairways with woods on both sides. And he said every time he cannot stop it. He can't help looking into the woods and trying to find danger and looking. He said it was about 6 years ago now, but he said 3 years ago when I was speaking with him, he said he was walking in downtown Ottawa visiting his daughter who lives in the city, and he said a bus backfired. And he leapt over the hedge into the lawn beside him. He's in his 70s, and it's still right there. He still wakes up, not every night, it used to be, he said, but at least once a week, he wakes up in the middle of the night screaming with nightmares. Picture, 20,000 Canadians fought. Now, why would they do that? I asked him and I asked others that I spoke with and others that I read about. One of three reasons. Doug Carey said, when I was growing up, almost every man in my life, from the hockey coach to the barber to the teachers to my dad to my uncles, was a veteran. They fought in Korea. They fought in the Second World War. I just thought that was a ticket to manhood. It's something that is expected. Many people said, When I spoke or read about, they said, well, we have been told our entire lives that we have to fight communists. And there was only one place where communists were being directly confronted, and that was in Vietnam. So, yes, I wanted to join the army for the military for the same reason Doug Carey said, but I want to go where I can actually fight, and the only enemy is in Vietnam, and the only way I can fight the only enemy in the world right now, the communists, is by joining the American forces. Over they went. And then the third, I think, is universal, and it's been forever. A number of young men, when you're 18, decide, you know what, if I come back in a uniform, the girls are going to love me. And all three of those were the reasons why so many Canadians went. Let me tell you about the last person. Last person is a person by the name of Rebecca Trin. She lives in Calgary. Spoke to her many times on the phone. And she is an amazing woman. And she is one, again, I think we know about the so-called boat people that came after the Vietnam War. Because the Americans left in 1973. By 1975, the communists had taken all of Vietnam. Think about that. In 1975, what happened? The communists were in charge. They had one country. And the foreigners were out. Exactly what Ho Chi Minh said he wanted in 1954. 58,000 Americans, nearly 200 Canadians, over 3 million Vietnamese died for what Sherwood Lett said in 1954 and Blair Seaborn said in 1964 would happen. Well, the Vietnamese and the Chinese had a little border skirmish in 1975. A whole bunch of people left in 1975, but these were people with money. So they could, you know, get a plane ticket and go buy a place in Canada, the United States, or Britain, or Germany, wherever they went. But in 1978, end of 77, 78, there was a border skirmish between the Chinese and the Vietnamese. Didn't last long. But what it meant was that the Vietnamese government started to act against anybody who was in Vietnam of Chinese heritage. And there was thousands. And these people were losing their business. They were having their jobs taken. The kids were being kicked out of school. They were put into re-education camps concentration camps and work camps. And so a number, and again, thousands of them said, we've got to leave. These were not people with a lot of money now, so they had to go through the process that many of us know with the Syrians recently and others on boats and just horrific conditions. Rebecca Trin was a journalist, and her husband, Sam, these are our anglicized names, obviously, and her husband, Sam, was a business owner. He owned his own importing business. So they were middle-class people living in Saigon. They had to leave. I won't tell you the entire story of them leaving. I'll only tell you one incident. And this struck me because this, I think, is a metaphor for not only their struggle, but the struggles of all who left Vietnam, so many of them, over 50,000 of them, that settled in Canada. Again, a part of Canada's involvement in the Vietnam War. They were on this ship. The ship was holding about 350 people. They were trying to get to Indonesia. They knew there were refugee camps in Indonesia. They got within sight of the shore. They could see the trees in the horizon when an Indonesian naval vessel threw a chain onto their ship and towed them back out into international waters. And through a loudspeaker, the captain from the Indonesian naval vessel said, you keep going that way, and in 4 days you'll be in the Philippines and you'll be safe. Well, the captain of the, and then they left, the captain of the refugee ship knew that they didn't have enough food or water to do that. So he tacked north on the Indonesian shoreline until there was a moonless night 4 days later. He got as close as he could, about 3,000 yards from shore, and he said through the loudspeaker, grab anything that floats, jump, and swim for shore. Now, here's Rebecca Trin and Sam. They have their four-year-old daughter and their two-year-old daughter. Now, I'm guessing that many of us are parents or grandparents like I am. Picture this. Sam jumped into the water from the ship's deck, which would be like jumping from a second-story window into the icy, and not icy, the inky black water below on this moonless night. Rebecca looked down, saw the splash. He then screamed up, throw Judy. The four-year-old thrown over, and she heard the splash. Picture a mother doing that. Heard the splash, and Sam yelled, I've got her. Now you too. Now picture a mother. I talked to my wife about this after, and she just could not imagine it. You've got a two-year-old child screaming, Helen, the two-year-old, and you're standing on the deck. Now what do you do? Rebecca told me, she threw her as high as she could in the air, dove down into the water, hit the wind, came back up to the surface as quickly as she could, heard a splash, grabbed, and got Helen, got the two-year-old. Now, that's an incredible story. They then swam the 3,000 yards to shore. Now, I tell in the book their story as part of all the stories of the ones that got through the camps and all the degradation and starvation, the thing that took them over a year to get to Canada. They arrived in Edmonton. Sam set up a business again. She became first a waitress, and then as she learned English, got another, a better job. And they ended up buying a house. They moved to Calgary, and where I spoke with them. They're doing very well, thank you very much. Just like almost all of the refugees that came. They came as part of an organization that Canada set up. The Joe Clark government set it up. He was only in power for 9 months, but he's the one that set it up, where a group or a church group or even a group of individuals would sponsor somebody, and everyone that they sponsored, the government would sponsor one. And that's what Canada used in 2015 when the Syrians came. And in 2015, all they had to do was dust off what happened in the Vietnam War. Britain, France, Germany, and many other European, Australia, New Zealand, do you know what they use when they bring refugees in? The Canadian system that we set up to bring the Vietnamese. What is interesting, I don't know if you ever watched, you ever watch The National at night? CBC The National? I don't know if you were watching The National last night. There was a young woman, and at the end of her report, she said, and this is for The National, Judy Trin. That's the four-year-old that got thrown over the ship. That's her. So next time you're watching The National and you see Judy Trin, just think, you now know the story. You read the book, you'll see a little bit more of the story. So they're the six people. And that, I think, tells a little bit about Canada's involvement. Of course, I've skimmed through, as I do in these talks. There's a whole lot more in the book. There are four lessons, I think. And I'll end you with this. There's only four lessons. One, it talked about Canada's soul, because our nationalism grew in those years as a result of the Vietnam War. The Vietnamization of the United States led to the Canadianization of Canada. We decided after the Second World War that we can't tie ourselves to Britain. We've got to wean ourselves away from Britain. The dominant in our lives will be the United States now. In the Vietnam War era, Canadians, by and large, decided, no, we are going to not be American. We need to be more Canadian, not just anti-American, but pro-Canadian. Canadian nationalism grew as a result of the Vietnam War. It also taught us about our heart, because we put our hearts into rescuing the war refugees, be it either the draft dodgers, over 30,000 of them, or the boat people, over 50,000 of them. It tugged and changed our hearts. It also touched our wallets, because you think about what I was mentioning before. We made the decision that we would take the profit and we would take the jobs, even though we knew the war was immoral. Right now, there's a war going on in Yemen, in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia is doing things to that little country that are just horrific. Justin Trudeau has stood up in the House of Commons and said this is an immoral war, and the Saudi Arabians should stop what they are doing. Canada has voted in the UN that Saudi Arabia is wrong in what they're doing in Yemen. Every year, Canada makes over $1 billion by selling war material to Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen. Mostly it is armored vehicles made in a factory in London, Ontario. So it looks like we didn't learn the lesson about morality versus profit. And finally, brawn. Yeah, we've learned about our heart, we've learned about our soul, we've learned about our wallets, we've also learned about brawn, about sheer power. Because despite the fact that we were right, Sherwood Lett was right, Seaborn was right, Claire Culhane was right, the Americans ignored us. The Americans simply ignored us. We learned that if you don't have an economy and if you don't have a military that is of a certain size and might, then you can be ignored. But you know what else we learned? That maybe because we will be ignored, we can stand up and publicly support our own principles. That is the lesson that John Chrétien learned. And he talked about this. He talked about it as a lesson from Vietnam when he stood up to George W. Bush and said, no, I won't go to Iraq because I don't believe the weapons of mass destruction and that whole lie that was to justify that war. And he stood up and he said, no, I will not go to Iraq. Where did he learn the historical lessons that he could stand up to the American and there would be no economic blowback? We would pay no economic price for standing up to our principles. He learned from what happened in Vietnam. We are small enough to be ignored, but we're big enough that we can stand up and say what we think is right. I'll leave you with only one story. It's the last story, I promise. In 1965, our Prime Minister, Lester Pearson, who had already won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1956 for his work in the Suez Crisis, was going to be given another Peace Prize. And he, in order to accept it, he went down to Temple University in Philadelphia to accept this Peace Prize. While he was there, he delivered a speech accepting the prize, and he praised the Americans for standing up to the communists in Vietnam and said that Canada supports the Americans' efforts in standing up against communism. But I don't think it's a very good tactic for the Americans to continue to bomb civilians in the North. I don't think bombing and killing civilians is a way to win a war. By the time he left the stage, there was a phone call waiting for him. He took it in. There was no cell phones in those days. He took it in a janitor's office. And the President of the United States wanted to talk to him. The next day, he went to Camp David and he had lunch with Lyndon Johnson. I don't know if you recall Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson, 6'4", big guy, powerful guy, rough-talking Texan. Ignored Pearson during the lunch. During the lunch, he was screaming into the telephone at McNamara, one of his cabinet ministers, about Vietnam and telling him how he was screwing up and swearing and dropping the F-bomb every other sentence. And then he slammed the phone down and looked at Pearson and said, "Come with me." They walked out into a patio. So they were outside. Johnson, the President of the United States, then grabbed the Prime Minister of Canada by the lapels of his jacket, lifted him off the ground, screamed and said, "I read your speech. How dare you come into my place and piss on my rug? Don't do it again." Threw him down. Now, Mr. Trump got mad at our Mr. Trudeau, but you know what? Nothing like that ever happened. I think that was a very unique moment in Canadian-American diplomacy. I will leave you with that story. And what I would like to do now is invite you to talk to me about this book and ask me any questions you would like to ask about the Devil's Trick, how Canada fought the Vietnam War. So.